From Matt Smith. Subject. Number 57, Kobuk Valley, and number 58, Gates of the Arctic National Parks. Date, August 27, 2012. Dear Bob and Sue, Chloe, the enchilada dog, stared at me again while I ate breakfast this morning. She was wearing a new sweater, one I hadn't seen yesterday. Karen didn't invite Chloe onto her lap this time, though. Breakfast was huge. I ate all of mine and then ate Karen's bacon. Just once in my life I'd like to see how much bacon I could eat in one sitting. Never have I thought, "No, I can't eat that last piece of bacon, I'm full." Karen said we have to finish our parks trip before I eat enough bacon to kill me. Her concern for my health is touching. Tom sat and visited with us while we drank our third cup of coffee. The more we talked with him, the more interesting his life seemed. Tom, like many Alaskans, is a pilot. He became familiar with Bettel's Lodge during his many stopovers to refuel his plane. I was surprised when he told us that he stopped flying just a few years ago. He also told us about the large game he'd hunted over the years, and then, with a distant stare out the window, said, "I don't have guns anymore." Tom's hunting days are over. Before he retired, Tom taught college courses on interpersonal relationships. He told us that he knows just by looking at a couple if they enjoy being together. He said he watched us when we first arrived at the lodge, and could tell by our body language and the way we looked at each other that we were a couple who has fun together. Karen smiled at me when he said that. It was one of those times when I got extra points for doing absolutely nothing. But I'll take them, because it doesn't happen very often. Clouds were still hanging around at mid-morning, but the lodge manager was fairly certain the weather would clear enough by the afternoon for us to fly into the parks. The manager didn't seem to like me very much, even though I used all my charm on her, so I made Karen ask her when we should be ready to go. I heard her say, "Probably not until 3 or 4 p.m., but late afternoon is a great time to go because the lighting is perfect for pictures. We can pack a picnic dinner to take with you. Check back with me at 11 a.m. for an update." At 11 a.m., I took the bait and made the mistake of asking her for an update. She snapped back, "Didn't someone already tell you when you're going?" I didn't have an answer for her that wouldn't get me thrown out of the lodge or put on the next plane back to Fairbanks, so I just smiled and went back to writing my emails to you guys. There's not much to do in Bettel's, so we didn't stray too far from the lodge all day. We went back to the visitor center and watched an hour-long documentary about Gates of the Arctic. In the middle of the film, the door to the screening room opened, and in walked a guy dressed entirely in buckskin, carrying a large bow with several arrows attached to it. He walked through the room and exited through a side door. It was surreal for us, I'm sure for him as well, like he had somehow taken a wrong turn in the wilderness and ended up in front of a large flat-screen TV. "It's Alaska," Karen said to me, and went on watching the film. The rest of the time we hung out at the lodge because I was pretty sure, had we left to go for a hike for a couple of hours, we would have returned to learn we missed our window of good weather with a curt message of, "Sorry, you missed your chance. We'll have to try again later this week, or maybe next. Now just sit in the corner until we call your name." During lunch, I commiserated with a man and woman who'd been sitting in the lodge all morning. The woman said to me, "Don't feel bad. We've been here since 8 a.m. this morning, and no one has told us yet when we'll be leaving." They were waiting to be flown into Gates of the Arctic National Park for a week-long float trip, just the two of them, father and daughter. We drank beer with our lunch. A couple of beers. Karen felt that would calm me down a bit. It worked. After lunch, we looked through the lodge's guest books, reading where the guests were from and the comments they left. Apparently, a lot of people had been stranded here, waiting for the weather to clear enough to fly out. Around 3 p.m., one of the pilots, Bill, came in the lodge and told us he thought we would be going shortly. He said, "Yeah, I'll be taking you up in the 206 pretty soon." After he walked away, I asked Karen, "What is a 206? Is that a plane? Why do they do that?" Pilots always refer to their planes by names that would not make sense to anyone except another pilot. Beaver, Otter, Skywagon, 206. Bill had been flying all morning and was taking a break before our flight. After a quick lunch in the dining room, Bill went outside to the front porch and lit a cigarette. Karen was already apprehensive about taking the 206 into the parks, but finding out that Bill was a smoker gave her one more reason to worry. She whispered to me, "What if something happens to him on the flight?" I said, "What are you worried about? Do you think he'll develop lung cancer and die all during the course of our 4-hour flight?"
"No, what if he has a heart attack? Who will fly the plane?"
I wasn't going to let this turn into a serious conversation. I said, "Don't worry. If he keels over, I think I could bring the plane down." She replied,
"I could bring the plane down. We need someone to bring it down without killing us."
While we watched Bill finish his cigarette, a young man bounced through the front door of the lodge. He looked at us and said, "Hi, I'm Patrick. You ready to go?" We'd never seen Patrick before that moment. We're pretty sure he didn't know we were the couple that was scheduled to take the flight into the parks.
I'm guessing he would have whisked away any couple standing in the lobby at that moment.
Outside, he led us to an old pickup truck where Bill joined us. Karen and I slid into the back of the cab. Patrick and Bill climbed in front. Patrick drove us out of town on the gravel road we'd walked last night. We were headed to the small lake where the float planes take off and land. A mile out of town, Patrick looked at us in the rearview mirror and said, "I'm going to be taking you into the parks today. Is that okay?" I knew he was joking, but Karen wasn't so sure. He continued, "Yeah, I'm still learning to fly, so Bill thought this would be a good chance for me to get some experience flying through the storms between here and the Kobuk." Bill didn't react. He just stared out the front of the truck and kept quiet. Karen started looking a little green. For a moment I thought our parks journey was going to end right there. Patrick had no way of knowing we were not the people he should be joking with about plane safety. I shook my head at Karen, trying to assure her that Patrick wouldn't be our pilot. At the pond, Patrick and Bill readied the plane. Bill was putting gas in the left wing when he looked over at us and said, "You okay with a little turbulence?" Without hesitating, I answered, "Yeah, no problem." I thought about it for a moment, then asked, "How much turbulence are we talking about?" "It shouldn't be too bad." "Then why did you mention it?" I thought to myself. Now I was the one worried. I dug through my backpack and found my tube of 10-year-old Dramamine. Karen had a full water bottle, so I swallowed a pill with a couple of long gulps. Bill asked which one of us wanted to sit up front with him. I looked at Karen, and she said, "God, no!" Karen climbed in the single back seat, and Bill placed our backpacks next to her. Karen kept the plywood Kobuk sign at her feet. With the co-pilot seat pushed back into Karen's knees, I wriggled my way across the pilot seat and settled in the front right seat of the plane. It was hard getting in without bumping against the controls and switches on the dashboard.
I could imagine the windshield wipers flapping and the radio blaring like a high school practical joke when Bill started the engine. Or worse, that in flight he wouldn't find that one critical setting that I'd changed until it was too late and the plane was plunging to the ground. I decided not to say anything and assume he would check them before the flight, like pilots are supposed to do. Besides, I'm sure he's had more clumsy passengers with bigger butts than me shoehorn themselves into the co-pilot seat before. Bill taxied the plane slowly to one end of the pond, giving us room to take off and allowing the engine to warm up. When Bill turned the plane toward the direction of our takeoff and gunned the engine, I was surprised at how close we were to the trees on the approaching shore. But my concern was unnecessary. By the time we reached the trees, we were well above them. In an instant, we were high enough in the sky to see for dozens of miles in every direction. The dark gray, treeless mountains to the north had a dusting of snow from earlier today. We'd made it here with no time to spare. Winter was coming soon. Bill said their last flight to pick people up in the backcountry would be September 16th. After that, all the planes are flown to Fairbanks, where they spend the winter. 20 minutes into the flight, I felt a slight urge to pee. I thought nothing of it at first. I can hold it with the best of them. The first leg of our flight to Kobuk Valley National Park was 175 miles. In another hour, we would be there, and I could go then. No problem. We flew in and out of rain showers, but could see the sun most of the time. Multiple rainbows in the distance rose out of the unspoiled landscape. I was trying to concentrate on the scenery and take pictures, but the urge was growing at an unusually fast pace. Maybe it was the two beers I had at lunch, or the huge amount of water I drank with the Dramamine, but soon there was only one thing on my mind. Where's the bathroom? There wasn't, of course, a bathroom. We were quite literally in the middle of nowhere. Bill wasn't going to land the 206 on some random lake so I could relieve myself. I needed to start thinking about plans B and C and possibly D.
I could see the controls. We were flying at about 110 knots. And the park was 175 miles away.
I didn't like the way the math worked out. I wasn't going to make it. I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. Man up and hold it. My silent pep talk made me feel better for about 30 seconds. Then the urge came back even stronger than before. The three of us were wearing headphones with microphones attached to them that rested right in front of our mouths. The microphones were voice-activated, but there was about a one-second delay from when I started talking to when I could hear the microphone activate. But if I stopped talking and waited for the microphone to activate, it would shut off again, and I would have to start over. I finally realized that I needed to start every sentence with, then continue talking. It was important that I figured this out because it was the only way to communicate with Bill. Once I knew he could hear me, I said, Bill, I'm going to have to pee before we get there. I'm going to go in a dry bag that I brought with me. Without expression, Bill said back to me, yeah, no problem. I looked back at Karen, and her face was stricken. With wide eyes, she mouthed, what, to me. She had long given up on trying to talk into her microphone. She thought, because of the odd delay of the voice activation, that her microphone wasn't working. I could see her slink down in her seat in disbelief. Once I had notified everyone, I still needed to come up with a plan on exactly how to do it. It wasn't like I could unbuckle my seatbelt and climb in back to have some privacy. We were in close quarters. Bill and I were sitting so close we were nearly touching shoulders. Whatever my plan, it was going to happen right there in the co-pilot seat. I reached my left arm around Bill to feel for my backpack. I couldn't reach it and had to ask Karen to kick it toward my hand so I could dig through it for my dry bag. Karen reluctantly helped me out. She was trying to act like she didn't know me and we weren't together. Nice. I was able to feel through my pack and locate the dry bag. It was full of snacks. I pulled it into the front of the plane, took my snacks out, and put them in the pockets of my rain jacket. This took way longer than I thought it possibly could. I had enough in there to survive for a week. It made me think about whether I really needed to carry around so many year-past-their-expiration-date Clif bars in my backpack. Once the bag was empty and ready for duty, I still had some things to work out. To add to my dilemma, I was buckled in tight. A shoulder harness was over my chest and connected at a very inconvenient spot with my seatbelt. I'll fast-forward past the other problems I had and skip to the part where I'm holding a warm bag of pee on my lap. Phew! I'm glad I had that dry bag with me. I'm glad I had it with me, but this particular dry bag wasn't as dry as I had expected it would be. I think it was designed to keep moisture out, not so much to keep moisture in. I began to think about how that could be. Shouldn't it work both ways? Soon my contemplation about directional moisture flow was quickly interrupted by a more immediate problem. I needed a dry bag for my dry bag. Luckily, I came prepared. I reached around Bill again to dig through my backpack to find the 13-gallon tall kitchen trash bag I always carry with me. I double-bagged my pee, placed it on the floor at my feet, and relaxed. Just then, the great Kobuk sand dunes came into sight in front of us. It was perfect timing. There are three active sand dune areas in the park, totaling over 20,000 acres, the largest being the Great Kobuk Sand Dunes. Even though they're in the Arctic, temperatures on the dunes in the summer can reach 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Bill told us he would land the plane on a lake close to the sand dunes so we could take our picture before leaving again for Gates of the Arctic. We would have liked to have gone ashore and hiked the dunes, but there wasn't time. Bill took our picture as we sat in the plane holding the Kobuk sign. It was the shortest visit we'd made to any of the parks, but certainly the hardest to get to. Within 20 minutes we were back in the air and heading toward the next park. It was roughly another hour of flying before we reached Walker Lake on the southern edge of Gates of the Arctic National Park. Bill first circled the area of the lake where he planned to land, looking at the water to determine the strength and direction of the wind. He put the plane down and taxied to a small point of land that had a shallow approach and a narrow sandy beach. Bill cut the engine as we neared the shore and got out onto the float. A few feet from dry ground, he stepped into the water and guided the plane into its final resting position, tail first toward the beach. I don't remember one specific moment when I felt a sense of accomplishment that we'd made it to the final park, but once we were on land and climbed to the top of the small bump-out, Karen turned to me with a raised hand for a high five. This time I connected with her on the first try. We'd made it. The mosquitoes were thick as they hovered around our faces. I could imagine they would drive someone crazy who was camping here. We only stayed long enough for Bill to put another few gallons of gas in the plane and take our picture. He wanted to fly us over the Aragetch Peaks on the way back to Bettles, and that was going to use up our remaining time. Aragetch is an Inupiat word meaning fingers of the outstretched hand. The peaks are part of the Brooks range of mountains that cut through the park. As we taxied away from shore, I looked at the peaks rising in front of us. Their highest point was over 7,000 feet in elevation. On the lake, we couldn't have been higher than 1,000 feet. I wondered to myself if our little 206 could climb that high that fast, but with calm determination, Bill got us up and over them with ease. He'd done this countless times before. The peaks are spectacular, charcoal-gray spires reaching up to the sky. Clouds from earlier in the day had mostly cleared, and the sun was in perfect position to give high relief to every rock on the surface of the peaks. Despite my bitching about waiting around all day for our flight, this was the perfect time of day to fly over the peaks. We were close enough to the mountains to see every detail. I scanned each one, looking for wildlife, hoping to spot a mountain sheep or goats. At one point, I looked back at Karen to find her slumped down in her seat. I think mentally she was done with our journey and just wanted the plane to get back on the ground safely. The scene outside the plane looked a little too much like Lake Clark Pass for her comfort. Once past the peaks, Bill angled the plane toward home and followed the Alatna River out of the mountains. With the sun at a low angle, the river looked like a silver thread lying on a green carpet. Where the valley leaves the park to the south, the elevation drop is so slight that the river meanders back and forth, nearly connecting with itself on each switchback. I can only imagine how this landscape will change in the next couple months as the temperature drops and the snow falls. A few miles from the pond, we heard over our headphones one of the other Bettles pilots calling for Bill. He had just taken off from the pond with another couple from the lodge for a flight-seeing trip into Gates. He announced his position and altitude, as pilots are supposed to do, so Bill could keep a safe distance. "Bill, this is Brad. I'm at 2,000 and just over the bend in the John," the other pilot said. He was referring to the John River, which connects with the Koyukuk River a few miles west of Bettles. "Where are you?" he asked. Bill replied, "I'm at 2,600 just west of the bend. I should be able to see you, but I don't." Brad said, "I don't see you either. You must be right on top of me." Karen and I were frantically looking in every direction, trying to spot Brad's plane. Bill calmly replied, "You stay at 2,000, and I'll keep it at 2,600 for a little bit longer, and we should be fine." Compared to our fender bender, tail bender, actually, in Lake Clark Pass, 600 feet of separation seemed more than safe to me. Karen wasn't so sure and kept looking for the other plane until we were almost on the pond. At the dock, Karen and I climbed out through the door on the pilot's side of the plane. We unloaded our backpacks, mine a little heavier than when we started, and the Kobuk sign, and waited by the pickup while Bill tied up the plane and did a few post-flight chores. Regardless of how outrageously expensive the flight is, it's customary to tip the pilot for his or her services. That is, if they've done a good job. I got out my wallet, and Karen and I agreed on a reasonable amount for Bill's tip. I added an extra $40 to the tip. $20 for not killing us, and $20 for letting me pee in his plane. Bill seemed genuinely appreciative. Back at the lodge, the other guests were finishing dessert. I grabbed two beers from the cooler by the front desk, and Karen claimed the corner booth in the dining area. Since there was no picnic dinner on our flight into the parks, we were hoping they had saved us some dinner, but eating was merely an afterthought. It was beginning to sink in that our two-plus-year journey to visit all the national parks was complete. We were deeply relaxed and satisfied. One of the lodge workers brought us dinner, and just as we were about to eat, Tom came by and asked if he could join us. He asked, "Are you sure it's okay for me to sit with you while you eat?" we welcomed his company. Tom was beaming. We had told him earlier that these were the last two parks on our journey. He was happy for us. We ate slowly and talked about our flight into the parks and how good it felt to reach this milestone. The conversation turned to a variety of subjects, but eventually Karen began asking Tom about his future. "Are you going to stay here this winter?" she asked. "No, I'm going to go back to Washington State next month. My kids keep asking me to stay with them. They want to take care of me," he said. Karen asked, "So when will you come back here? Next May?" Tom paused before answering, "I don't know if I'll be coming back. This might be my last summer up here. I say this without feeling morose, but I feel the end coming." Karen's eyes watered. I replied matter-of-factly, "It comes for all of us, doesn't it?" Tom nodded in agreement. "And I'm fine with it. It's natural. I've had a good life." He left us to make more coffee, and we sat there quietly for a few more minutes. We avoided a sad goodbye with Tom, knowing that we'd see him in the morning before our flight to Fairbanks. The only thing left on our list was to see the northern lights. We still had several hours before the sky would be dark enough to see the aurora. That's what they call the northern lights here in Bettles. One of the lodge staff said, "For us the lights aren't in the north, they're right overhead. We just call it the aurora." Some of the camera crew and another couple staying at the lodge had the same plan to stay up to see the lights. We visited with them and wandered around the grounds waiting for the sky to darken. Some of them were drinking beer and playing horseshoes on the side yard of the lodge. Every now and then we'd hear the clank of metal on metal. They were still playing well past the point where it was light enough to see what they were aiming at. I was waiting for the inevitable yelp when one of them scored a ringer around someone's shin, but it never came. At 1 a.m., Karen and I were pacing the gravel runway trying to keep warm. We were wearing all of the clothes we'd brought with us. The moon was nearly full and on the rise, making it harder to see the lights. At 1:30 a.m., we heard someone say they could see them. We walked over to where they were standing and looked into the sky in the direction they were pointing. At first, I couldn't see them and was ready to give up, but a few minutes later they came into faint focus. I'd thought they would be stationary, but they weren't. The lights were wispy and moved quickly as if being blown by the wind. We stood on the cold gravel for another half an hour watching, as the lights got brighter and the shades of green intensified. I'm glad we stayed awake long enough to see them. On the last day of our 2-year journey to some of the most spectacular places on Earth, this incredible light show was a fitting finale. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Going Home. Date, August 28, 2012. Dear Bob and Sue, the lodge was bustling when we arrived for breakfast. Like yesterday, clouds hung low in the sky, but the forecast was for clearing. The camera crews had their gear stacked in piles outside. Everyone was ready to fly into the park. Karen and I slid into a booth with our coffee. Tom came over and sat across from us. Pointing to the group standing outside, he said, "These guys told me last night they would be up at 4:30 getting ready for their trip, so I got up at 4 to make the coffee." "What time did they show up?" I asked. Tom chuckled and said, 6:30. A staff member brought us breakfast of bacon, eggs, and French toast. All of our meals at the lodge were fantastic. We ate and shared small talk with Tom. He looked tired. Tom asked us if we'd enjoyed our trip. Karen said, "The two great things about this trip were seeing the parks and meeting you, Tom." That was very sweet. Karen always knows the right thing to say. Our plane was scheduled to leave at 9 a.m., but we were packed and ready to go well before then, so we killed time visiting with the other guests. I stood outside in the cold morning air and talked with one of the cameramen. He told me about all of the adventures he'd had filming amazing places around the world. He looked to be about my age. He shuddered and said, "I only have a couple of years of this left in me. I need to go somewhere warm like Southern California and just sit on a beach." The plane, taking us back to Fairbanks, landed at Bettles about 8:45 a.m. There was a rush of activity getting the bags onto the plane and making sure everyone who was supposed to go was there and ready. Karen ran back inside to say goodbye to Tom, and then we climbed into the Piper Navajo through a door in the back. Our pilot buckled himself in and gave us the speed-talking version of the safety briefing. I could tell Karen wanted to say, "Slow down, this shit's important." Instead, she looked at me and slowly shook her head. Within a few minutes, we were accelerating down the gravel runway and into the air. It was an uneventful flight to Fairbanks, but Karen was on the lookout for other planes the entire time. At the Fairbanks airport, we were hours early for our flight to Seattle, but we went through security anyway. There couldn't have been 10 other people in the airport as we sat in the snack bar staring out the window at the planes. Karen started to tear up. I knew it wasn't because our parks trip was over. She said, "When I said goodbye to Tom, he told me that he would think about us often." She choked up and had to stop for a moment. "He said we're rich, and he wasn't referring to money. He said we're rich because we have each other and we have time, and that's all we need." Neither of us spoke for a long while. Karen and I don't know what our next adventure will be. There's a part of me that wants to do it all over again, exactly the same. And another part that doesn't want to ever see another list. Whatever we do, I'm sure we'll have fun. Anyway, we have time to figure it out. Next go-around, you should come with us. Your friend, Matt. The End. Almost. From Matt Smith. Subject: Number 59, Pinnacles, Don't Call Me a Monument, National Park. Date: April 1st, 2013. Dear Bob and Sue, 3 months after we published Dear Bob and Sue, our book was obsolete. Out of nowhere came a new national park, Number 59. In January 2013, Pinnacles National Monument in Central California became Pinnacles National Park. As soon as we found out, Karen and I started making plans to visit the new park. We already had a short vacation scheduled to Palm Springs for late March as a break from the Seattle rain, but this news gave me an excuse to extend the trip, and a chance to combine visits to two of my favorite places, a national park and a brewery. My new plan was to rent a car in Palm Springs, drive from there to Pinnacles, and then drive back to Seattle, visiting Russian River Brewery along the way. Karen was totally on board. She has visions of loading up the rental car with as much Pliny the Elder as they will let us buy. Pliny the Elder is a double IPA that is extremely difficult to get anywhere outside the Russian River Brewery tap house. One thing we had to consider when planning our drive was which side of the park to visit. The road into the park, Highway 146, enters from both the east and the west, but doesn't continue all the way through. You can't drive from one side of the park to the other. A ridge of mountains, the Pinnacles, divides the park north to south. We decided to visit the east side because that's where the visitor center is located. Yesterday afternoon we left Palm Springs and drove to Paso Robles, where we spent the night. This morning, after turning into the park off a mostly deserted Highway 25, we drove straight to the visitor center to get a stamp for our park passports and some advice for a hike. The ranger at the visitor center asked us a few questions and then recommended High Peaks Loop Trail, about a 7-mile hike. He gave us a park map and explained in detail how to find the trailhead. With map in hand, we left the visitor center and took our picture by the new park sign on the side of the building. It's the only sign in the park that reads Pinnacles National Park. After one more check of the map before leaving the parking lot, we realized that neither of us could remember which trail the ranger recommended.
"Wow, we are getting old. I thought it was just you losing your memory."
I don't remember which of us said this to the other. Doesn't matter. We looked up from the map and without hesitation went back into the visitor center for round two of our information session with the ranger. This time he used a green highlighter to outline the trail. I had to keep myself from diving in front of the map when he pulled out the marker. But knowing where we're going when we are in the middle of the wilderness is more important than having a pristine map for the files back home. I was pretty sure this wouldn't be the last time today we'd forget what he told us. As we headed back to the car, I slipped the second park map into my backpack. The ranger had originally suggested a hike that led to a bat cave. He said it was easy and family-friendly. "What else you got?" I thought to myself. The hike he suggested had two strikes against it. One, it leads to a cave, and two, we don't do family-friendly. It's not that we don't like hiking amongst families. Really, I enjoy tiptoeing through a young family's picnic when they've decided to have a mid-morning snack, right in the middle of the trail. That's how those goldfish crackers got stuck to the bottom of my hiking boot. Or listening to parents speak every thought that comes into their head while learning to parent.
"Alexandra, this is a leaf. Can you say leaf? Oh, here is another leaf. It's green. Can you say green? Here is another. Don't eat the leaf, Alexandra. Do not. Honey, I could use a little help here. Don't let Alexandra eat the leaf. Where's Zebulon? He was right here. Zebulon! Zebulon, don't eat the dirt. Honey! Zebulon!"
Nope, we're past that point in our lives. We're at the stage where we're looking for family hostel hikes. As it turned out, the High Peaks Loop Trail was just the right amount of family hostel for us. Who names their kid Zebulon? Pinnacles hasn't gotten the same attention as many of the other national parks, but it has a long history of being part of the national park system. In the span of 7 days in 1908, Teddy Roosevelt made it a national monument along with John Muir and the Grand Canyon. The main entrance sign, which still reads Pinnacles National Monument, has an old stone foundation that looks like it's from the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, days of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm sure the visitation numbers will be up this year now that it has National Park in its name. Since it was still early in the day, we were able to find a place to park in a pullout alongside the main park road just before it forks toward the Bear Gulch Day Use area. It took a little while to figure out exactly which direction we were supposed to go and to find the trail, but after a couple of false starts, we were going in the right direction. The first mile or so of the hike was flat and followed the park road to a dead-end parking lot. From there, the trail became steep, switchbacking up a canyon. Up to then, we had no idea what a pinnacle was. What I mean is, we knew what pinnacles are— tall, pointy rocks, but it's not clear when driving through the park where they are or what they look like. It's not like Mount Rainier, where you can see the peak from 50 miles away. Karen started pointing to every rock larger than a Volkswagen, asking, "Is that a pinnacle?" As the terrain became rockier, with large rocks grouped together, she'd ask, "Do you think those are the pinnacles?" It got annoying by about the 25th time she asked. It actually got annoying sooner than that, but I'm being kind. How would I know a rock from a pinnacle? Does she think that sometime during our last 32 years together I secretly became a geologist and never told her? I had no idea what a pinnacle was. Finally, I distracted her with a rare offer to stop for a rest and have a snack, so I could take some pictures of the view. She said, "I hope you're taking pictures of the rocks. These could be the pinnacles, you know. We don't want to get all the way to the top and find out that..." She changed her voice to what sounded like Yogi Bear. "Oh, sorry. Those were the pinnacles you passed earlier. There aren't any more along this hike. Hope you got some good pictures." Before I could figure out who would be telling us this at the top of the mountain, a pair of hikers interrupted us as they walked through our mid-morning picnic. As they tiptoed around our backpacks and water bottles, I apologized. "Sorry, we didn't realize we'd spread out in the middle of the trail." The elevation gain on this hike is about 1,500 feet. Before we got to the top, we came to where the trail met the shorter Condor Gulch Trail. We stopped and thought about turning off and going back down toward our car. It was tempting. We were tired and we couldn't see anything interesting ahead, but we kept hiking up the trail. By the end of the hike, we were glad we hadn't wimped out. Over the next half of a mile or so, the trail continued to gain elevation, but more gradually than before. Pretty soon we were hiking among massive boulders. Not quite pinnacles, but impressive still. An older hiker, older than us, was on our tail the entire time. My instinct in these situations is to hike faster to put some space between us, but no matter how fast we went, he hung right behind us. He must have been in his mid-70s, at least. We couldn't shake him. Finally, reluctantly, with simultaneous shame and awe, we let him pass. My desk job is making me soft. I need to spend more time on the trail. As he sprinted past us, we decided it would be a good time to stop for lunch. Karen and I ate while sitting on boulders next to a quiet stretch of the trail. This morning, on our way to the park, we picked up sandwiches in King City. Besides the camping supply store and the visitor center, there's no place to buy food in the park. Being early spring, the weather changed by the minute. When the sun came out, it was instantly a beautiful warm day. A moment later, it would be cloudy and cool enough to remind us that winter was just 2 weeks ago. Like so many of the wilderness areas in the national parks, the space around us looked like it had been professionally landscaped, every plant put in just the right spot to make a perfect scene. Many plants were blooming, with bees buzzing about. The park's website says there are nearly 400 species of bees in the park. 260 species of bees have been spotted along the 2.3-mile Old Pinnacles Trail alone. How do they know that? I've hiked hundreds, if not thousands, of miles in the national parks and seen countless types of bees, but there's no way I could describe a bee to a ranger in such detail that they could tell it was a different species than one of the other 259 species already described by passers-by. About this long, bug eyes, yellow body with black stripes, two wings and furry legs. I said to Karen, "How could they know that 260 species of bees have been seen along a single trail in the park?"
It would take teams of entomologists forever to categorize that many bees.
Karen laughed so hard water came out of her nose.
What's so funny?
An entomologist studies the history of words.
I thought they studied bugs.
She laughed again.
They might in their spare time, but their job is to study words.
Who studies bugs?
Entomologists study insects.
I thought that was the guy who did my root canal.
I think that's an endodontist.
I think you're making up words. Regardless, I'm calling bullshit on this one. Even if endocrinologists spent years hovering along the trail looking for bees, it's hard to believe they would have found 260 distinct species. Far above the bees, circling the pinnacles, were large black birds. We thought they were California condors, like the ones we saw along Bright Angel Trail in the Grand Canyon. Farther up the trail, we came across two researchers who told us the birds we saw were turkey vultures, not condors, which are a different type of vulture. The researchers had a radio antenna and were trying to pick up signals from tagged condors. Karen was disappointed. She had been hoping to see a condor. I'm not sure why. I've seen a California condor close up. They're just as butt-ugly as a turkey vulture, and they share some of the same charming features. They both have bald heads, so they can clean them after sticking them into rotting animal carcasses. They pee on themselves to regulate their body temperature, and they throw up in self-defense. And we saved these birds from extinction, why? I made the mistake of saying this out loud in front of Karen. What followed was an impassioned and near encyclopedic explanation of why saving the condors was important. Apparently, she had been reading about the plight of the California condor as part of her research on the park. Finally, I said, "Okay, okay, I get it. The world is a better place because we saved the condors." But they are condors, not condors.
No, they're condors.
She was pronouncing it condors.
Condors, not condors.
No one calls them condors. They're called condors.
No, they're condors.
No, they're condors.
This dialogue continued for quite a while without much variation. You get the gist. Suffice it to say, I stopped making fun of the condors, and Karen made a point of emphasizing the door part of the word condor for the rest of the day. Maybe condors is the correct pronunciation now that I think about it, but I'm not going to take it back now. I have to admit, though, the story of their survival is impressive. In 1987, the 22 remaining wild condors — Karen stressed that they were the last 22 wild condors in the entire world — were captured, and the species was bred in captivity until there were enough to begin reintroducing them into the wild. Pinnacles has been a part of the California Condor Recovery Program since 2003. The park now manages over 30 free-flying condors. We didn't see any condors today. At least we don't think we did. After lunch, we packed up and continued hiking along the high ridge. There's no sign along the trail that announces that you are officially in the Pinnacles, but by the time we had reached our lunch spot, we were clearly amongst them. We'd thought we were already at the highest point of the trail, when suddenly we were standing at the base of a series of footholds carved into a pinnacle. Running alongside the shallow steps was a metal railing. "There's no way Alexandra and Zebulon would make it up these," I thought to myself as I started climbing. That wasn't the last set of carved footholds and metal railings we encountered. There were several steep pitches and sudden drop-offs along the trail that required our undivided attention. The stairs were so narrow they could only be climbed single file. Hikers coming from the opposite direction had to wait.
When we came to a section that looked out over the west side of the park, it was easy to see from our vantage point why there isn't a road that crosses the park east to west. There's no way through the pinnacles. The views from the top were beautiful, but hard to capture with my point-and-shoot camera. At one spot along the top I stopped, no longer hearing Karen's footsteps behind me. She was 50 yards back taking a picture. I thought for a moment she was trying to capture the landscape, but instead she was focusing on a squirrel, which seemed to be posing for her on its hind legs. She was breaking her own trail etiquette rule. It was clearly below the 2-pound limit to qualify for a wildlife sighting. She kept taking picture after picture on her phone. As I made my way back to where she was standing, she glanced at me and put her finger to her lips. "Finally making friends?" I asked.
"Never," she whispered. "Oh, how the tables have turned."
"What does that mean?"
"It means I have this little guy right where I want him. He's completely exposed on this big rock, nowhere to hide, no friends around to call for backup. I think he's frozen with fear. Look how he's holding his paws. It looks like he's praying."
"And what's preventing him from taking a flying leap and landing on your head like the last time you cornered a squirrel?" She took a step back and put the camera in her pocket.
"I'm done," she said.
Soon after that, we came to the point where the trail started back down in elevation, looping back to where we'd parked. There's always a feeling of relief when you start back down after a steep climb. The hikers we met coming up looked exhausted and could barely breathe. We were joking with one another and greeting each person we passed with a cheerful, "How's it going?" I think Karen may have been skipping behind me. Needless to say, we were glad to be on our way down. Toward the end of our hike, we came to a turnoff that led to Bear Gulch Cave. While I doubt I'll ever be a fan of caves, I like bats. They're amazing creatures, and Karen regrets calling them blood-sucking, rabid rats with wings. Maybe we'll put up a bat house when we get back to Seattle. By the way, many species of bats have excellent eyesight, despite the fact that many people think they are nearly blind. Bats get a bad rap. The ranger here had told us that they close part of the Bear Gulch Cave 10 months a year in order to protect the Townsend's big-eared bats, a sensitive species. From mid-May to mid-July, the entire cave is closed because it's pupping season. A baby bat is called a pup. 14 species of bats live in the park. In addition to Bear Gulch Cave, bats also live in the Balconies Cave area. While Pinnacles protects their condors and bats, they've removed pigs from the park because they're not native to the area. Exotic, invasive feral pigs were once a big problem in the park. They competed for food with deer and other wildlife and had the potential to spread disease to other animals in the park, including humans. Their rooting behavior was destroying plants and insect habitat and caused soil erosion problems. They were being pigs, so the Park Service had to get rid of them. In 2003, the park constructed a 24-mile fence around the perimeter to keep them out. After the fence went up, it took another few years to rid the part of the pigs that were on the park side of the fence. Since 2006, the park has been mostly pig-free, of the four-legged kind anyway. The last couple of 100 yards of the hike ran through a dry, sandy creek bed. Pine cones were scattered about. Big, perfect pine cones. They were just big and perfect enough that I wanted to take one home for my pine cone collection. I have 2 pine cones in my collection so far. But it's against the rules to take anything out of a national park, so I left them where they were. We drove out of the park and headed north toward San Jose. Again, there was very little traffic on the road just outside the park. I drove about 2 miles an hour, close to the shoulder, looking for just the right pine cone to take home. At first, Karen was encouraging, but her attitude quickly soured. The first one I stopped for looked perfect from my vantage point in the car. Karen got out and held it by its tip, like she was holding a fine piece of artwork so I could inspect it.
"How's this?" she asked.
"Spin it around," I said. "Nope. It's wet on one side." With a deep breath, Karen flung the rejected cone into the ditch alongside the road and got back in the car. We repeated this scene several times. Each new candidate looked good from the car, but had some flaw that required me to reject it. Too dirty, crooked, color faded on one side, too sappy. By the fifth stop, Karen didn't ask my opinion. She grabbed the closest one to the car, tossed it in the back seat without even looking at it, and said,
"It's perfect. Let's go."
I'd flown too close to the sun and knew better than to push my luck any further. As I drove away, I could see in the rearview mirror my brand-new, crooked, dirty, two-toned pine cone in the back seat with its sap side stuck to my backpack. It was time for a beer. We're official again. We can now say we've visited all of the national parks. Although I'm getting tired of explaining that we've only been to the 59 parks that are national parks. I suggested to Karen that on our drive back to Seattle we take a side trip to visit the John Day Fossil Beds National Monument east of Bend, Oregon. She looked at me with raised eyebrows and asked,
"Why?"
"Well, you know, since we are going right by, we should stop and see the park."
"We are not going right by. It's at least a 3-hour detour. Seriously, why do you want to go?"
"You know why."
"No. We are not going to visit all 342 remaining national park sites."
"Why not?"
"My park passport is nearly full. I don't have room for 342 more stamps."
"I'll buy you another passport."
"What about all the park sites we've already visited? Are we going back to Bent's old fort?"
"Well, next time we're in the area, we could stop by. Besides, you liked it. Remember how all the park employees were dressed like trappers and traders from the 1840s? And had to stay in character even when I asked them where we could find a gas station in the area?"
"So we're going to spend every free moment we have for the next 20 years driving to places like that in the middle of nowhere?"
"Exactly. It'll be fun." I didn't mention to her that at the rate they're adding new park units, it might take more than 20 years to visit them all. Karen didn't put up as much of a fight as I'd expected. I'm taking that as a yes. Bob and Sue, how about you? Your friend, Matt. This concludes Dear Bob and Sue by Matt and Karen Smith. Narrated by David Colacci and Susan Erickson. Copyright 2012-2017 by Matt and Karen Smith. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Matt and Karen Smith and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.